with a kind introduction. I too would like to thank the Zajac Foundation and the University of Vienna, Professor Mattis, and all the other conference organizers for a most edifying symposium. As someone who specializes in Japanese Buddhism, I'm a bit of an outlier to the subject matter of this conference. It's been most edifying. So thank you all very much. Yesterday, Professor Kumagai introduced you to the concept of original enlightenment. The doctrine of original enlightenment denotes a discourse, or more properly, a group of discourses that emerged in Japan from the influential Tendai school during the medieval period. That's around the latter 11th to the 12th century that it appears and then flourishes until roughly the 18th. In essence, Hongaku doctrine rejects the idea of enlightenment as something acquired. It asserts that Buddhahood is neither a potential to be realized nor a goal to be achieved, but the true status of all things. Ordinary deluded people do not transform and become Buddhas. We are Buddha already from the outset and have only to realize it. The radiant Buddhas with their extraordinary marks who appear in the sutras are not real Buddhas, but merely provisional signs. The real Buddha is the ordinary worldling, the Pratijñāna, Bonbu in Japanese, just as he or she is. Liberation depends not on such actions as moral cultivation or merit accumulation, but on the insight, or even the faith, that one is Buddha originally. Now, whether in praise or censure, original enlightenment has often been characterized in scholarship as peculiarly, or perhaps even aberrantly, Japanese. It's been celebrated as the climax of Buddhism as philosophy, in that it pushes to the limit the implications of Mahayana non-duality. It has also been attacked as an uncritical world affirmation that in valorizing all things as enlightened just as they are, in effect denies the need for practice and legitimates evil conduct. Alternatively, the advocates of so-called critical Buddhism, Hakamaya Noriaki and Matsumoto Shiro, who I believe we're going to hear more about this afternoon, have denounced it as a sacralizing of the status quo that endorses social inequities. I've addressed these criticisms extensively elsewhere. I myself do not see Hongaku doctrine as either aberrant nor particularly Japanese, but as an extension of broader Mahayana ideas. I also argue that original enlightenment thought does not deny the need for practice, but rather reconceives it. And today I'd like to explore that reconception, showing how Hongaku, original enlightenment doctrine, reinterprets the relationship of practice and enlightenment in light of its claim that we are enlightened already. So first let me provide some brief background, and then I'll give some illustrations from a specific text, the 12th century Shinnyokan, or Contemplation of Suchness. Original enlightenment doctrine draws heavily on Chinese Mahayana notions of liberation as entailing insight into the nature of the cosmos as a holistic, non-dual, interrelated realm in which all beings, being empty of fixed substance, interpenetrate and contain one another without losing their individual identity. And we can roughly identify three major versions of this concept. One is the idea typically associated with the Huayan school that all phenomena emanate from an originally pure, undifferentiated one mind. Liberation lies in discerning that phenomena of the samsaric world are in essence no different from the one mind and thus originally pure. And in East Asia, by the way, the term Tathagata Garbha is usually reserved for that kind of model, emphasizing an original one mind. A second model, coming out of the Tiantai school, places greater emphasis on the phenomenal. The mind and all phenomena are always simultaneous and inseparable. No hierarchy, no before or after obtains between them. This position rules out notions of primal purity, the mutual inclusion of good and evil, delusion and enlightenment, and all sentient beings and their environments, from hell dwellers to Buddhas, is the true aspect of all things. This model is associated with the famous Tiantai threefold contemplation, to see phenomena as empty, as nonetheless conventionally existing, and as neither one-sidedly empty nor conventionally existing, but exhibiting both aspects simultaneously. That is the middle way. And then we have a third tantric model that sees the phenomenal world as the body and mind of the omnipresent cosmic Buddha Mahavairochana. And this model is associated with the tantric techniques of mudras, mantras, and mandalas, by which the body, speech, and mind of the practitioner are aligned, or perhaps we could say synced, with the body, speech, and mind of Mahavairochana. So while differing in their emphases, all three visions of a non-dual interpenetrating universe imply an ontological equality of the Buddha and living beings and suggest a reconceptualizing of the phenomenal world, not as a realm of suffering to be escaped, but as the very realm where liberation is to be achieved. That is the premise on which medieval Japanese Tendai original enlightenment thinking develops, and the text that I'm going to introduce draws on all three of these models. So let's turn to this contemplation of suchness, the Shinyokan. This work is attributed to the Tendai master Genshin, but it actually dates considerably later, to around the 12th century. The word shinyo translates tatata, or suchness, and is used in this work as a synonym for Buddha nature, original enlightenment, and the Tendai threefold truth. The Shinyokan belongs to an early phase of original enlightenment discourse and illustrates Hongaku ideas as they were just starting to take shape. Some extant versions of the texts are written in vernacular Japanese rather than the literary Chinese customarily employed for Buddhist writing, and certain passages suggest perhaps an educated lay readership. Let's first begin with the basic argument. The opening passage reads in part, "If you wish to attain Buddhahood quickly, you must think, my own mind is precisely the principle of suchness. If you think that suchness which pervades the Dharma realm is your own essence, you are at once the Dharma realm. Do not think there is anything apart from this. When one is awakened, the Buddhas in the worlds of the 10 directions and also all bodhisattvas dwell within oneself. To seek a separate Buddha apart from one's own person is the action of a time when one does not know that oneself is precisely suchness." So the essential practice recommended here is to continually generate the thought that oneself is suchness. According to the text, this attitude may be cultivated in connection with other practices, such as sutra copying or recitation or chanting the Buddha's name, or as a practice in its own right. But in any case, one should arouse this thought amidst all daily activities, walking, sitting, standing, or lying down. Being simple to practice, the contemplation of suchness is touted as suitable for everyone. Clergy or laity, male or female, all should contemplate in this way. One should contemplate not only oneself as suchness, but also others. Other human beings, of course, but also animals, down to the tiniest ants and crickets, and insentient beings as well. Because grasses and trees, mountains and rivers, the vast sea and the empty sky are all suchness, there is none that is not Buddha. So according to the Shinyokan, because suchness is the real aspect of all things, to regard both oneself and others in this way is to access a dimension in which individuals are not separate, unrelated or conflicting existences, but non-dual, each pervading the totality of all that is and encompassing all others within itself. It is, in other words, to see all beings as manifesting original enlightenment just as they are. The text then makes two major claims. The first is that this single practice contains the merit of all practices. For example, when one offers a single flower or lights one stick of incense before a single Buddha, because that single flower or stick of incense is precisely suchness, it pervades the Dharma realm. And because the single Buddha to whom it is offered also is precisely suchness, that one Buddha is all Buddhas, and the countless Buddhas of the 10 directions without exception all at once receive that offering. And this principle is said to hold true not only for specifically religious acts, but mundane activities for as well. So here we get this suggestion maybe of a lay readership. When you provide for your wife, children and retainers, or even feed oxen, horses, and other domestic animals, if you think these others are precisely suchness, you have in effect made offerings to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the 10 directions and to all living beings without a single exception. Thus, this single thought, this is suchness, produced with respect to whatever comes within one's field of consciousness, transforms the action of that moment into Buddhist practice and contains infinite merit that refracts boundlessly throughout the cosmos. A second major claim is that contemplating suchness overrides defilements and karmic obstructions. So here we have a passage. From today on, knowing that your own mind is itself suchness, you will not be hindered by evil karma or defilements. Fame and profit will instead become nourishment for enlightened wisdom. Even if you should violate the precepts without shame or be negligent and idle in religious observances, so long as you always contemplate suchness and never forget to do so, you should never think that evil karma or defilements will obstruct your realization of Buddhahood. Actually, I think that to always contemplate suchness and never forget to do so, simple, but not easy. Anyway, the claim here is that one does not eradicate defilements because defilements and enlightenment are non-dual. Rather, in the contemplation of suchness, defilements are somehow naturally redirected in a soteriologically efficacious way, a liberative way. Passages like these have understandably drawn criticisms that Hongaku doctrine is ethically problematic. We can imagine, however, that efforts to always contemplate everything as suchness and never forget to do so might do much to obviate evil actions. The Shinryokan, in fact, suggests as much in a subsequent discussion of the single error that will block liberation and perpetuate samsara. That error is to regard oneself as a limited, separate existence whose interests are opposed to those of others. Failing to regard that ourselves and others are equally suchness, we arbitrarily regard as self what is not really the self, arousing anger toward those who oppose us and possessive attachment toward those who affirm us, and thus continue to undergo deluded rebirth. Moreover, we read, because suchness is the essence of all Buddhas, one who disbelieves that everything is suchness slanders all Buddhas throughout time and space. The Shinryokan seeks to discourage this unwholesome attitude with an overview of karmic retribution in the lower rebirth realms. First, it rehearses the sufferings in the 8 major hells. But it dwells kind of idiosyncratically on the animal realm, and especially on small insects, inviting the reader to contemplate the plight of crickets, ants, and even the countless invisibly tiny creatures that inhabit each of our 84,000 pores. When, it asks, will beings like these achieve liberation? birth in such a small body, the Shinryokan asserts, is the fruit of attachment to a narrow concept of self. But in the act of contemplating oneself and others as equally identical to suchness, one returns to the reality of original enlightenment, and one's body and mind at once fill the Dharma realm. The suggestion here is that failure to perceive suchness, the mutual encompassing of all things, ultimately will contract the self into a small, constricted form, while contemplation of suchness opens one's person to become coextensive with everything else. Realizing that self and others are not essentially different, one no longer gives rise to the egocentric impulses that perpetuate samsaric suffering. Now, let's turn to the status of practice as represented in this text and take a look at this passage. When you eat, if you carry out this contemplation of suchness, the merit of the perfection of giving at once fills the Dharma realm. And because one practice is equivalent to all practices, the single practice of the perfection of giving contains the other paramitas. And because cause and effect are non-dual, all practices, which represent the causal stage, are simultaneously the myriad virtues of the stage of realization. Thus, you are a bodhisattva of the highest stage, a Tathagata of perfect enlightenment. So when we break for lunch, you might want to remember this. Here we see a third major claim, that in contemplating suchness, the myriad virtues of complete enlightenment are immediately accessed in the practice of the present moment. Now, according to the Shinryokan, this extraordinary idea that the totality of the Buddha's supreme awakening can be realized in a single moment's practice is unique to the Lotus Sutra, which was revered in the Tendai school as the Buddha's highest teaching. Other provisional teachings are said to represent the inferior perspective of acquired enlightenment, in which to reach awakening, one must first eradicate defilements and accumulate merit and so forth. So the Shinryokan tells us that according to sutras other than the Lotus Sutra, provisional teachings, bodhisattvas of those provisional teachings, ignorant of the contemplation of suchness, for countless kalpas carried out difficult and painful practices, not begrudging bodily life, and thus attained Buddhahood. But it was not real Buddhahood, only a provisional fruit achieved in a dream. Those who know the contemplation of suchness become Buddhas in an instant. So here we have a denial of Buddhahood as a future goal, the culmination of a linear process of cultivation and attainment. Instead, we might call this a mandalic idea of Buddhahood, as always and fully accessible in the present. And this is really quite a legitimating move going on in this passage here. You notice that it rejects the model of practice established by Shakyamuni Buddha himself, who is said to have achieved Buddhahood only after countless kalpas of austere disciplines. In the words of the Lotus Sutra itself, there is no place in the Trikilyakosm, not even the size of a mustard seed, where the bodhisattva did not cast away bodily life for the sake of living beings. But medieval Japanese Tendai exegetes found room in the Lotus Sutra to question this conventional linear model of practice and attainment. And in chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra, that's in Kumara Jiva's Chinese translation, Shakyamuni Buddha reveals that he had not, as everyone thought, achieved enlightenment for the first time in this life under the Bodhi tree. Rather, he has been the Buddha since the inconceivably remote past. His departure from his father's palace, his practice of asceticism, his search for the way, and even his entry into final nirvana were all his skillful means, a pedagogical device. In fact, he declares, "I am always here, preaching the Dharma." So there are many ways that that sentence has been, that passage has been read in the history of Lotus Sutra interpretation. But for medieval Japanese Tennai thinkers, they took this revelation of the Buddha's primordial awakening as a metaphor for the originally enlightened status of all beings, an enlightenment to be fully accessed in the moment of practice without traversing successive stages. One might, in fact, understand medieval Japanese hongaku thought as an effort to rethink the entire received Tendai tradition from that perspective. Now, at this point, the text posits a common sense objection. I don't understand how we can all be Buddhas without distinction. A Buddha is one who possesses the 32 marks. This is like Shinran's objection that Professor Kumagai told us about yesterday. Someone whose supernatural powers and wisdom surpass those of all others. I'll skip part of this. Even if you call yourself a Buddha, you do not possess the 32 features, nor have you gained supernatural powers. Arousing surpassing arrogance, you call it the Buddha wisdom, a boundlessly grave sin. How do you respond? So on the one hand, this seems like a naive question, confusing an ontological equality of the Buddha and all beings with the liberative realization of Buddhahood itself. But it also serves, it's a setup. It serves to introduce a new understanding of what Buddha is, seen from a hongaku perspective. And the Shinryokan responds with a reinterpretation of the six stages of identity. This is a traditional Tiantai Marga scheme, a model of the path. It goes back to the 6th century Chinese patriarch Juri, long before the emergence of original enlightenment thought. I won't go through the whole thing, but the first stage, identity in principle, is the stage of a deluded person who has not yet heard the Buddha's teachings, but nonetheless, in principle, is equal to a Buddha. And the second stage, called verbal identity, or myojisoku, this denotes the initial stage of practice, at which one encounters a teacher or a scripture and understands at a verbal or a conceptual level that all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, you know, when intellectually understands non-duality and gives one's assent. Then there are four subsequent stages of cultivation, eventually culminating, probably some lifetimes hence, in perfect Buddhahood. And this word identity in the name of each stage is a reminder that whatever one's level of attainment, low or high, ontologically, one is no different from the Buddha. There's an equality there. Now, according to the Shinryokan, if we were to define or categorize the contemplation of suchness in terms of this traditional model of the path, it would correspond to stage two, that of verbal identity. And this is important, actually. If the original enlightenment doctrine said that you don't need to practice, then it would be stage one. It doesn't say that. Stage two is the contemplation of suchness. Now, this stage two, that of verbal identity, is conventionally understood as the very beginning stage of practice. But for this text and for original enlightenment discourse in general, it becomes the only stage that matters. At this stage, the Shinryokan says, we have already heard the name of the threefold truth and understood that we ourselves are precisely suchness. The distinguishing physical marks and supernatural powers belong to the later stages. But it would be the height of foolishness, the text insists, to regard those as defining characteristics of Buddhahood. Wheel-turning kings, after all, have the 32 marks, and non-Buddhists may possess supernatural powers. The real Buddha is suchness, and those who contemplate suchness are at once the Buddha of original enlightenment. Their every action is the mudra of suchness, their every utterance is a mantra, and their every thought is esoteric contemplation. In short, the entire path reduces to the move from stage one to stage two. And between those two lies the entire difference between liberation and bondage, between knowing that all things are suchness or not knowing it. Now, somewhat later Hongaku texts explicitly collapse all the later stages into that of verbal identity, the initial stage of practice, so that the path turns back on itself and the end is present in the beginning. We could say that the original Enlightenment discourse is committed to asserting an absolute temporal non-duality, undercutting the idea of practice as a graded progression toward a future goal. Any notion of Buddhahood achieved as the end result of cultivation over time, the position of acquired enlightenment, is dismissed, either as an inferior provisional view or as an outright error. Now, Hongaku doctrine, as I mentioned, does not deny the need for practice, although it has often been represented that way in scholarship for reasons that I don't have time to get into. Rather, practice is no longer instrumentalized. It is not a means to enlightenment, but inseparable from it. Of course, we experience time in a linear way. And the Shinryokan acknowledges that due to individual differences in human capacity, not everyone will readily be able to sustain the insight that all things are suchness. Most of us, beings with dull faculties, may think in this moment, I am suchness. But at the next moment, easily give way to greed, anger, and so forth in reaction to external circumstances. So this is something that can be gained, lost, regained. That is why continuous contemplation of suchness in all activities is stressed. Even we read, while lying down with one's sash untied. Depending upon one's faculties, one might need a day, 2 days, a month, 2 months, a year, or even a lifetime to solidify this contemplation. But anyone can do so with this present body. Crucially, this development, this solidification of the contemplation of suchness is represented not as progress toward an external goal, something out there in the future, but as a deepening of an enlightenment one already has. So in concluding, we could say that this work, the Shinryokan, illustrates two broad features of original enlightenment thinking. First is an inversion in the relation of practice and enlightenment. Enlightenment is no longer the goal of practice, but its foundation. Practice is not a means to enlightenment, but its paradigmatic expression. And some other slightly later texts in a Hongaku vein speak of this as a reversal. One abandons the perspective of proceeding from cause to effect, that is, from practice to enlightenment, and adopts the perspective of moving from effect to cause, that is, from enlightenment to practice. Some scholars have termed this a Copernican revolution within Buddhism. In any event, one does not traverse stages. Because enlightenment is originally inherent and accessed fully in the present moment, it does not depend on accumulating merit or eradicating defilements. There is cultivation, but cultivation means deepening one's awareness of a Buddhahood always and already present. Second, the concept of Buddhahood itself changes. The Shinryokan's claim that the real Buddha is suchness leads to what we might call an anti-transcendent move. In this discourse, Buddhahood finds expression not in supernatural powers or extraordinary signs, but in daily activities. It is immediately accessible without extirpating delusion. This perspective is touted as far superior to the idea of Buddhahood as an ideal state cultivated over kalpas. But one trades for this accessibility, the ideal of someday becoming a perfected being. Rather, one manifests Buddhahood while remaining an ordinary, deluded worldling. Later texts in a hongaku mode would further develop this idea, asserting that the Buddha of original enlightenment has transcended August Marx and belongs to the mundane world. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very fascinating account. And there's a first question already.
My question would be, has there any sort of an attempt, either on the part of traditional scholars or modern scholars, who try to find traces of such concepts or ideas or sociological models in the Indian sources? This would be one question. The second question is the idea that, I don't know if here or the Putakjana is already like, this is very reminiscent of the Dzogchen idea that that descendant beings are actually princes, but wandering around as beggars. So it's just a matter of recognizing whether one is a prince or not, but even as he wanders as a beggar, he has never changed his princely status. I mean, so this is very kind of somewhat, I find some similarity. So these are the two.
Thank you. I'm so happy to hear this comment. I should give you a little bit of background. The notion of original enlightenment was discovered by scholarship, so to speak, in the early 20th century. And this is, of course, the time when Japan is modernizing and trying to compete with the West. And intellectuals need to answer the criticism that Japan has religion but no philosophy. And so they find in this, well, here is our philosophy. And so there's been a tendency ever since to look at this as something that's distinctively or even uniquely Japanese, which for me raises a red flag. And so I don't know, there have been a few attempts to find parallels, for example, in certain forms of Chinese Chan, but I think there needs to be a lot more work done on finding what are the continuities on the Asian continent, both in Indian and Tibetan materials. With the Tibetan material in particular, I mean, Tibet and Japan are both cultures where Buddhism has a tremendously strong esoteric, tantric influence. And I really hope that next generation of scholars will do more to compare those two. It's what has been done thus far is not adequate by any means. And the Dzogchen reminded me, I heard of Dzogchen first from Brian Cuevas, who I think some of you know, and it struck me, oh, this sounds really familiar. So I think that you may be right. I myself don't have the expertise, but this is an open field for future research, so I hope somebody will look into this. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. That was extremely interesting. The text you discussed, does that also give you concrete ideas how to practice, how to focus on this suchness?
You know, it's really interesting. I chose this text for this conference because it spells things out a lot more than many of the texts dealing with this concept. One problem we have is that this material comes down. It begins as oral transmissions. Then these are recorded on strips of paper, and then they're collected, and they sort of become the lineage possession of monasteries, and they're passed down in a monastic world. And it's very, very difficult to get a sense of what century specific texts are written in. This one you can pin down to an actual century. It's amazing. Who wrote them? They tend to be attributed to great masters of the past who we know didn't write them. And most importantly, what role did they play in the overall religious life of individuals? Very, very hard to get at. I doubt that this doctrine structured the entire religious practice of very many people. So this text actually tells us more about specific practice than many. And so no, we don't, for this, where you find specific instructions is, you know, something like Pure Land, where there's a lot more, you know, how to, or Chan, you know, how to sit, how to think, how to focus the mind. So here, I think we would have to read more widely in meditation instruction and so forth. But there is this focus on the single moment.
Sounds like a more mindfulness
movement. In a way, except, in a way, yes.
Yeah, sort of building on that question, how does this look in an institutional setting? I mean, this sort of, you can envision everyone just wandering the fields, feeding their oxen, and you know, contemplating suchness. But what are the monasteries? How do they deal with this?
You know, it's really interesting. Like I said, these are tend to be handed down as secret transmissions. Even this writing looks like originally it was a bunch of separate transmissions that were compiled. It takes place, it's part of debate training, it's part of doctrinal training, it's part of lineage definition, and there's always a presumption of secrecy. You know, you are originally Buddha, shh, don't tell anybody. And of course, everybody knows, it's obvious that there's a lot of cross-fertilization across different lineages and so forth. We do know this is a doctrine that has an immense impact on Japanese literature, on the formation of what we call medieval Shinto. So it's definitely spilling out of the monastic institution. We can find it in poetry, popular songs. So we know that there is a broader impact. But trying to isolate the cultural surround is very difficult. I suspect that it was one mode of Buddhist study. You know, in a monastery, you know, with some exceptions, it was very common that people would study different traditions, even if their own practice focused on one or two or whatever. And so that this would be part, one perspective on the religious life. Oh, when it came time to die, I think most people hoped for birth in the Pure Land.
The deluded part sounds very provocative. So I'll start with that. How can you say, I mean, Buddha has the sense of awakening from the delusion of...
Right, right.
This is quite provocative.
So you know these models of the path where, you know, first you extirpate the, you know, this level of defilement, and then the next level of defilement, and first desires, and then conceptual attachments, and so forth. And so this is the idea, if you just cut through this, it's direct. And there seems to be a claim for some sort of transformative experience. You know, like in this text, you know, like not knowing that you are suchness is bondage, you're gonna continue to be reborn probably in lesser and lesser forms. If you know it, that's Buddhahood. You realize some sort of, you know, identity or non-duality with everything there is. So there does seem to be a tacit claim for a transformation not only of consciousness, but one's way of being in the world that is never fully articulated. But it's definitely something, you know, the ideology is, it's in the moment. It's posited against the idea of this is a distant goal that we get to gradually. Of course, if that idea were not there, this argument would lose its force.
Yeah.
So it's parasitic upon it.
So I just thought in the moment of transformation or transcendence that you'd shed the delusion. Because they're often in...
They don't want to say that. They really don't want to say that.
They say sentient beings are no different than Buddhas except for the fact that they don't realize they're, you know, that type of idea.
Yeah, this goes a little further.
Yeah.
You know, it wants to say we attain Buddhahood as a deluded person. You know, the marks of the Buddha of original enlightenment is, you know, wearing an extra robe in the winter and using fans in the summer. You know, completely daily life sort of things. You
know.
Yeah.
Goal sustained the Pala Vajrayana, the goal sustained Vajra vehicle. So there is this whole discourse about in Cohen Bagriana, you're taking the goal as the path, so there's no linear progression from a starting point to path to a goal. And it gets taken up in Dzogchen in an interesting way because they talk about the Drodu Lam and the Drodu Mepe Lam. The Drodu Lam means the path that we travel. The Drodu Mepe Lam is a path where there's no traveling. The Drodu Mepe Lam is considered to be Ati Yoga Dzogchen. It's soul name, no effort. The eight vehicles leading up to that are the Drodu Lam, and they're called the paths of the mind, of the ordinary mind, whereas the Drodu Mepe Lam is the path of wisdom. So that sounded very much like this idea that you have kind of a model of the path that's very much the product of the mind trying to chart out a progression in terms of, you know, stages and so on, and then you have this model where there's no more stages, no more paths.
That's really, really interesting. I mean, there is an overall move within Japanese Buddhism of which original enlightenment, I think, is part to bring it closer to home, as it were, and the idea that the ontological equality ought to make for immediate access. And but this is really interesting to hear about the parallels, and I hope somebody, I don't have the expertise, but I hope somebody will do that kind of work in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Frank, for your very wonderful presentation. I have just one practical question about the citation of the Shin. So, you cited the Shin Ryokan. So, those who know the contemplation of suchness become Buddha in an instant. Is this the position of Shin Ryokan?
Of whom? I'm sorry, the order of whom?
The statement, those who know right. The contemplation of suchness become Buddhas in an instant, is this a position, idea of the order of Shin Ryokan? Author, yeah.
Oh, of the author, yeah. Yeah, who is not Genshin.
his position.
Right, author, yeah. Okay. Not mine, his. Right.
In that case, it seems to be a kind of a shift.
Well, it's really interesting. I think you're. It's a valuable observation.
Yes.
Kumagai Sensei is saying that since there's a distinction between those who believe in suchness, that they are suchness, and those who don't, it sounds like there's still an element of acquired enlightenment, and you can't get away from it. Because if we, let me see, if I can get back here. If not, then you're at the first stage here. And there is no difference, there would be no difference between a completely deluded person and a Buddha, and there would be no meaning to the religious life. Right? So this is a discourse that wants to make it as immediate as possible. But ultimately, we're left with the distinction between samsara and nirvana. And so I think that even the claim for original enlightenment, it has its force because there is a separation there that is irreducible. Otherwise, there's no point to practice, right?
Thank you. Okay, one more last question, please. In
this tradition, it is said that the inanimate universe is Buddha. What do they mean?
That is a really good question, and it's been much disputed. That is something that starts a little earlier than original enlightenment thought. There's a very strong claim in the Japanese Buddhist tradition. It's called the Buddhahood of Plants and Trees is the technical term. Some scholars tell us that this has to do with a Japanese innate love of nature. I'm not quite convinced by that. Other people say that it's an attempt to extend the boundaries of the Buddhist compassion as far as it will go, and that there shouldn't be exceptions. Everything is included. There are a number of texts that deal with this, and it's not a unified discourse. One of the most fascinating ones attributed to Ryogen in the 10th century, not written by him, again, considerably later. But it says, if you look at plants, you know, they sit there in meditation perpetually. And so they sprout, and that's the arousing of the bodhicitta. And then they grow, that's cultivation. And then they flower, that's the realization of Buddhahood. And then they die back, that's entry into nirvana. So it's like, you know.
That's a kind of poetic metaphor.
It's a poetic metaphor. So I don't, you know, it's a question I can't answer. I don't know what it means.
It's the Tibetan tradition, as far as I understand.
Yeah.
It's practically self-evident that something without a mind is incapable of accomplishing the path in that way.
That's the counter argument. Within the Japanese tradition, you know, there definitely we see it's used rhetorically, in the sense that the claim that Buddhahood is extended to insentient life shows a superior inclusivity.
But it could be also in the sense that phenomena are kind of pervaded by emptiness, or once they are the mind's projection.
Well, it's interesting because you know that we find this in Chinese Buddhism, well, not to the same extent. So, in the Chinese case, because the subject and object, you know, the individual and the container world are non-dual. When the individual attains Buddhahood, so does the environment, and so the enlightened person dwells in the Buddha land, whereas someone who is suffering dwells in hell, even though they may be occupying the same space. But then the Japanese exegetes want to say that they're going beyond that.
Okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.